everyone, and welcome to another Scots Wee Hay podcast. And today I'm joined by musician and novelist Colin McIntyre, who you may know as Mull Historical Society. Hello, Colin.
Hello, Alistair. Nice to be with you.
And we're going to talk about the most recent album, In My Mind, There's a Room, which brings together your love of music and of writing. Can you talk a bit about the idea behind it and how it came about?
Yes, this was a slightly different album than I've made before, because really it came around because of an invite I received from a good friend back in Tobermory, on Mull. And he is Gordon MacLean, who has run the Arts Centre and Tober in Tobermory for 25 years, and which actually was my old school building. So Gordon is a good friend and performs sometimes with me, and his son, Soren MacLean, performs in my MHS live setup. So Gordon got in touch to say that he was, when he was deciding to leave Antober, that he was looking for new premises. And really, you could have knocked me over when I got this email through saying that he'd found a nice sea view, characterful building, kind of turret window, and turns out to be the bank flat in Tobermory, so the old Clydesdale Bank building, if any of your viewers or listeners know it. And that building is quite significant to me because my grandfather, Angus McIntyre, was the bank manager on Mull, and he lived above the shop. So he and my grandmother lived above the bank for 40 plus years, really. And my grandfather was also known as the Bard of Mull. So he was a published poet all his life. And in fact, I think I've got one of his first editions sitting right here for anyone who can see this as well. Signed 1975. Actually says Clydesdale Bank. So he must have been doing a bit of banking and poetry that day. And Gordon's new space, his new rooms, turned out to be these very rooms that my grandparents lived in, and the room for his new studio. So I hadn't been in the building for 20 years since my grandmother left the building. And, you know, it was just kind of quite an unbelievable piece of news that this space I'd known so well in my childhood was going to be transformed in this way. And so Gordon said, look, you know, you have to be the first to come up and make some noise here. And that kind of coincided with a bit of a light bulb moment for me, because you mentioned earlier about bringing my kind of music and author sides together. And I mean, all of that in terms of storytelling was heavily influenced by my grandfather. So I thought that I would, for a while, I've been looking to work with authors and to see if I could collaborate with other people. I've kind of been quite a solo beast, really, most of my career, despite the Mull kind of moniker sounding like more. And so yeah, I'd always done all the words, music, everything myself. So so I thought, okay, I'm getting to go and record in a significant room to me, that I would invite some of my favorite writers if they would provide original words on a significant room to them that they hadn't, you know, published before, and that I would then go up to Tobermory, back home, and record the album in the bank flat. And that's what I did. So that's kind of how it came around. And that's the reason for the In My Mind, There's a Room, the kind of room concept. And the In My Mind, There's a Room title is actually an old song title I had, which, you know, I've got probably about 300 songs that I recorded before I even had my first album, Loss, out, you know, leading up to that, just demoing, and since I was a teenager back in Mull, a kid. That was one of those old song titles. And it just kind of felt, I just realized, all right, that fits now. You know, the song probably would have, like a lot of those should stay under the bed and not really. In fact, the melody on it is, in my mind there's a room, in my mind there's a room. It sort of goes, stop being used. And so I did actually use a little bit of that melody on the Alan Warner collaboration. So it was, you know, there were lots of things just kind of joined together. And then I went back home over two sort of stints last winter and made the album in the bank flat, in those rooms that I'd spent so much time at the foot of my grandpa, listening to the stories, the folklore. And he wanted, you know, probably as it already sounds, he wasn't maybe the conventional bank manager, and he lived above the shop. He would, nobody quite knew when he was banking or doing poetry. You know, there was whiskey in the safe. And bank flat was more than just a banker's residence. It was really a hive of all the characters, all the local, you know, would come up each night. There'd be sandwiches, drams on the go. And you could leave the bank flat with a poem stuffed in your pocket as much as an overdraft, you know. So so I think, and Gordon remembered my grandfather and was actually a teenager delivering milk there before I would even have any memories of the bank flat. So there was lots of kind of links and connection. And I just sent emails out to a list of authors to see if they would, you know, to try and nutshell what I've just explained to you. And the way I put it in a nutshell was to say, would you be Bernie to my Elton? So a lot of your listeners will know that Elton John has sort of famously collaborated with Bernie Taupin, the lyricist throughout his career. And as I said before, I'd always done everything myself. So it was really refreshing to kind of to work with other people's rooms, other people's stories.
And how did that process work? First of all, did you have a kind of hit list of the people that you wanted involved? You know, a kind of a fantasy list, if you like, saying if this was the perfect, these are the people I would like involved. Yeah, so that was how you began. And are most of them on the album?
Most of them are, actually. I mean, there was some bits of connection. I mentioned Alan Warner already. I mean, Alan has Mull and Argyll and Oban connections, obviously. And so Alan, who I've now subsequently done a literary event with up in Aberdeen together. So Alan, I hadn't met in person until more recently, but I hadn't met him during the creative process. We were just, you know, on email. Alan actually was very aware of my grandfather and had this poetry collection and, you know, some nice links. But no, I just as you described, Alistair, I basically had a kind of wish list, and on there are some writing heroes, you know, Sebastian Barry, the kind of Irish laureate, who kind of Booker winner of Secret Scripture. And I mean, I love all Sebastian's writing. Nick Hornby, Liz Lockhead, Val McDermid, Ian Rankin, Jacqueline Wilson, just because I've got two daughters, to try and get at least one brownie point with them. the Jacqueline Wilson, the children's author. And then there was other people, I suppose I haven't talked about this, but there was a few people like Marlon Robinson, who's a kind of Pulitzer Prize winning author, American author, who probably is one of my, probably I put down as my maybe favourite author. And I did get to, I got nice responses from some people who couldn't do it for various reasons. But I put this all down in a sort of email, sent it out, and tried to give a snapshot of these rooms and the stories and the characters. And as I mentioned earlier in Gordon's initial proposition to me, the turret window, you know, it's like, it's quite, the Clydesdale Bank Tobermory is quite an unusual building. I mean, growing up as a kid, it was just normal to me, but it's kind of got sort of turrets. And so the space itself is quite characterful and looks right down Tobermory Main Street. So, I mean, we could literally, Gordon can sit at the mixing desk and turn his neck, you know, about 30 degrees and see who's going into the co-op. So it's a really important vantage point. And it's also, that turret window is where my grandpa wrote his last poem, which is called Tinault Safari, because he grew up in Tinault. And so, you know, it was really strange going back after all this time, but also it just felt like home, you know. But within an hour or two of actually starting to make the album, I was running up and down the three flights of stairs to the Tobermory Bakery, it has to be said, quite a lot. And it just felt like that's I was just leaving my grandmother with her messages note and a few quid in my pocket. You know, that's because that was very much the routine. Both my sets of grandparents lived on Top Moray Main Street, so it was kind of heaven, really. You know, and I know the last time I was in the building, actually, strangely, I can put a date on it because it was the weekend that my first Mull Historical Society single charted, because my grandmother was leaving the flat, and the bank had said as long as they were both alive and wanted to live there, then they could be there. My grandfather passed away in the kind of late 80s. So this was sort of 2001, this party, and it was over the weekend. And as you would, you'd be waiting on your chart, you know, your sort of chart position on the Saturday night.
Sure.
I mean, it was all new to me then, but it was Animal Cannabis off my debut album, Loss. So I can actually pinpoint. It's kind of bookended for me in terms of the beginning of my career, and then, you know, album number nine, where I am now.
It's interesting, I hadn't thought about this until you mentioned the window. You know, you think about being in the room, but there's also this looking out of the room, or looking out of that room in particular, which you must have done from a very young age, and how that view has changed and all of those
Yeah.
things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was funny because I was standing with my elbows on the sort of window ledge of the turret window that really, I mean, you do feel you're kind of suspended right above Top Moray Main Street. It's quite a unique sort of, yeah, I mean, it is a unique view. I can't think of another building that would have that view. And I remember as a kid, me, my brothers, cousins, my dad would always do the same thing. You'd go into the turret window, and I mean, I'd sometimes go in maybe about five times in one visit. My grandmother would say nothing could have changed since the last time you were in there, and of course it had. And this time, I was now sitting with a guitar, and where my grandfather used to have his record player, and he would sort of sing along to Joseph Locke records and things like that, and just. And really, really point displaying that he was the writer in the family, not the musician, really, with his singing. But he would, because he'd had some strokes by the end of his life, and you know, we'd go up and sit with him if my gran was going out to get messages and stuff. So, and not to be too morbid, but he passed away in the room that I was the room I was using as the live room. So where their bedroom was.
Wow.
It's now the drum kit, and I was singing in that room. So you're right, it wasn't only me looking out. It was actually I was singing, like, Val McDermid's collaboration is called Room of Masks, and Val's room is actually about her writer's room, and
Yeah.
she's, you know, yellow walls, and she's talking about the Firth Forth, and you know, she interesting, you know, she's looking out from the East Coast and I'm on the West Coast, and then Stephen Kelman, who's the Booker shortlisted author of Pidgin English, one of my favorite books. So Stephen's become a bit of a friend. Stephen's song is A Red Flame Diner, which is the diner that he and his wife went to in New York after they'd got married. And so here I am sit standing in my grandparents' bedroom on a windy night in Top Moray, you know, singing about all these other
Yeah.
room locations. And but it was funny, you know, through the talk back at one point, Gordon goes, you know, I'm starting to think these songs are just yours. You know, it feels like they're kind of just, you know, passing through me in some way. And I think I felt that as well, you know.
It was interesting because I was thinking this myself. If I didn't know the processes or the story or the ideas behind it, or the if you hadn't said this is the lyrics by, would I think this is a Mull Historical Society album? And I think I probably would. You
Yeah,
know,
well,
yes, that's
yeah.
to do with your voice and the, you know, the instrumentation, but you've always been a storyteller in your songs, I feel anyway.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I sort of feel that that has come, as I said earlier, I realize more and more how that has sort of come from the storytellers in my family, you know.
Yeah.
And on Mull, I was quite lucky because I had the kind of writers in my McIntyre side, like my grandfather and my uncle Lorne, and my grandpa's books were in print, you know, his cassettes were on sale. You know, I could see that actually, okay, you can get something out there. And then on my other side, my mum's side of the family are the Kirsops, and they are the kind of plumbing family on Mull for many year, you know, many generations. And but they were all musicians. And so as a kid, I could go up to the bank flat and hear my grandfather talk about, you know, it could be anyone from Burns to Bukowski, you know. And then I could go to up to the plumber's garage, and it was actually set up as a rehearsal studio around all the plumbing materials. And so I was, I suppose, you know what it's like. I mean, growing up in the Hebrides, I suppose I didn't, in Mull, we didn't have a cinema. We didn't really have many, you know, the Mull Music Festival, which is more of a traditional festival. We didn't really have a lot of gigs to go to, or you know, no record shops or anything. But I think I was lucky that I had loads of folklore, loads of storytelling, and I've pretty much spent the last 20 years just digging into that, you know, shamelessly. And my novels as well, like my new novel set in Mull, and it's a crime novel, and it's out in May, and I was writing that while I'm making this album, and I was walking down the lighthouse path in Todmorie to the bank flat each morning or the evenings, and that's a kind of bit of a setting in my novel. And it was, you know, so I was kind of doing research on that front, to the extent that the final room of the album was Abbey Road. So the album was mastered at Abbey Road. So it was really nice to kind of start in the bank flat, finish at Abbey Road. But I actually left Abbey Road in a taxi, you know, full of the joys of having been there. And I could talk a bit more about that. Gordon had never been, so it was really nice to see it through his eyes. And we get into the Beatles rooms and hear my grandpa's voice coming out of the speakers, because he's the last, he's the final voice on the album. But the reason I mention that is I then, of course, left my manuscript for my novel in the taxi and spent the next 2 days having to get my novel, you know, so there's multitasking for you. And I did get it back, but it's just been a really fun year of making stuff, and it's nice when it's you get out of the head and it's kind of in the world, if you like.
And that's a lovely story in the sense that you've got this room that you'd known since a child, and then you've got Abbey Road, which is, I guess, is one of the dreams that you have as someone obsessing about music as a younger
Oh,
person. That that's the
totally.
ultimate of almost.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as a kid, you know, probably even more so than the music, Alison, I was actually, you know, the look of the Beatles, the haircuts, the I couldn't really get my hair to do it. You know, I mean, obviously, I'm in, this is me in the kind of 80s, early 90s, but I was still, if there was something came on TV about Beatlemania, I mean, even now, you know, even, you know, Buddy Holly and all these people, I was always quite obsessed with this stuff as a kid. Probably through my uncles, because they were, you know, they were playing a lot of. I mean, I was about 12 when I realized that all these amazing songs that my uncles were playing were not theirs, and actually they were Bob Dylan's and Neil Young's and the Band and the Beach Boys and so Stones and all the rest of it. So I was, yeah, for me, I knew about Abbey Road probably when I was a kid growing up in Todmorie. You know, I was aware of, that kind of heritage, or I was just really, really obsessed with where do people come from, you know, that kind of that get their creativity out. You know, I was, you know, obsessed with Liverpool, and my first ever tour, Support an Elbow, actually, as it was as MHS, was you know, finally, you know, well, you know, going around all the cities. And I remember the tour bus driver I had, who'd just come off the Tom Jones gig, so he was coming on to probably quite a different experience with us. But his family actually ran the Beatles tours, so he gave me a little tour on the tour bus, actually round on our bus, round all the, you know, all the haunts, all the spots you would go to. And so yeah, you're right. I think the it felt full circle to finish it in Abbey Road, and you know, to hear my grandpa's voice coming out of those speakers there. And I did turn to Gordon and said, you know, it smells a bit like the bank flat in here. The same sort of slightly damp So it was, I suppose the biggest sort of challenge, but also that I just really enjoyed, was how to work with somebody else's words and how to do justice to their stories. And every song, I knew if I was one of those authors, then when it was done and dusted at Abbey Road, I'd listen to my track first. I'd be like, okay, what? So I felt everyone had to be the best it could be, and one of the authors is also Jason Mott, who I just heard on a book podcast. I think it was a Simon Mayo book podcast, and Jason's based in North Carolina, and won the National Book Award in America a couple of years ago for a book called Hell of a Book, and his room is his uncle's kind of farm, cattle farm in North Carolina, which is titled All Empty Rooms Must Be Mourned. And it was just really, I get the impression maybe the farm just kind of died, and the rooms died and the animals maybe, and Jackie Kay's room is her, the first holiday she went on with her new family, which was actually to the west coast of Mull. So there's all these, like her room is, her song is Meltwater. And that comes from, just this bothy they stayed in with her new family. And so sometimes I knew a bit more about the rooms, and then some of the authors would say, do you want to know a bit more? And I'd sort of politely decline, because I just felt I had to kind of imagine and inhabit my own imagination, but also take their words where they took me in terms of style, melody, tempo. But and then there was certain things like the Nick Hornby. He was the first person to come on board. So when I sent out this email, Gordon said, "Look, if nobody comes back, you're going to make something up here, But I think my ambitions are always running ahead." And I thought, okay, well, I didn't really even tell Gordon that I had sort of come up with the title, that it was going to be, I just kind of thought, okay, I'll just reach out. And the next day, I got an email from Nick Hornby just saying, "Hi, Colin, this is wonderful. How could I not be involved?" And I thought, okay, well, we've got one. And it wasn't until further on in the process that I realized the first time I ever saw Nick Hornby's work, the Fever Pitch, his kind of debut memoir, author, novel memoir, was actually sitting in the room in the bank flat. And one of my uncles had dropped it, had said to us, "So you boys should read that, you'll enjoy it." And so I'd forgotten about that until I was kind of underway, with the recording.
It's amazing, these little nuggets of kind of coincidence or serendipity that are coming along. And I love the
Absolutely.
idea, almost like Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen in The Magnificent Seven. You're going, "We've got one, we've got two," and you're kind of
That's
building
right.
all these people up.
It was.
And how did the process work? Did you get the lyrics, the actual words first, and then apply melody and to it?
So in terms of process, in most cases I kind of did what I imagine Elton does, as plunk the typed lyrics. Well, I know that's what he does on the piano, or in front of me, and just see what happens. But I've never really been a songwriter that sits on my guitar all day or sits at the piano all day. I mean, my songs could just as easily come into my head on the tube or on a bus or, anywhere really. And sometimes better for that, not being too sort of defined by chords or, but in this case, maybe it was a bit different. I think I felt like my kind of arrangement sort of skills kicked in maybe more than ever, because some of them would just be, I'd said to them maybe 30, 40 lines, but whatever you want, this is what I'd said to the author. So some of them, like Ian Rankin, so Ian was the second to come on board, because he was up writing on Cromarty and said, "If I can get something, should be the end of the month. How about that?" And I thought, okay, great. And the funny thing is, just as a little aside on Ian, we'd subsequently asked all the authors for a picture of maybe the room, or something visual, and not everyone had something, but We got some, and Ian actually sent one of an unmistakably sort of unmistakable Ian Rankin at maybe 14 years old in his bedroom. And of course, there's a big Elton John sort of Yellow Brick Road poster behind him. And Ian's words, to answer your question further, I mean, Ian's words were actually already in lyric form. So Ian's song is "My Bedroom Was My Rocket." He actually had "Rocket Ship," which is really nice, but melody wise, I just went with "Rocket." And or title wise, I went with "Rocket." And you know, you could sort of see, okay, these are the verses. I think I wanted one more verse, and cheekily asked him, and he kindly sent me a bit more. And it was very much about, as it explains, you know, his bedroom was kind of safe place, his place he created, listened to music, his parents kind of waiting patiently downstairs for him to come for his tea. And then some of them were like Val's was maybe 40 lines of, you know, as I mentioned, her kind of room, and not titled. And then just at the end, she talked about this being the room of masks, you know, the room, the place she creates. And I thought, room of masks, that's the title. Liz Lockhead, her room, Lizzie's room is her first ever bedroom of her own. And her parents had lived in Lanarkshire in the kind of in-laws' houses until she was four. And it was the 1952, I think, and it was the coronation year. So she kind of brought in bits of "The Queen is dead, long live the Queen, the King is dead, long live the Queen." And she talks about having her own double bed and being out of a cot and away from these bars of a cot. It's very much a child's eye. And she talks about looking up in the lamppost, the ceiling. She thought she would wake up in the morning and think it was her bin, because she'd never had a bin in her room. And, you know, just little beautiful details and things about Virginia Woolf and the stuff she was reading. So that became the song. I mean, that took quite a bit of, it's quite an upbeat sort of pop song if it was the first single, called 1952. But because Liz sent me so much material about this room and this really evocative telling of it, and so I felt like that also justified another song on the track, on the album. So the penultimate track is "Anaglypta," which is Liz reading her entire piece. You know, it's about a 4 minute long piece, and she came up to the bank flat to record that spoken word, and she called it "Anaglypta" because this new council house, she basically, the poem starts with her reading out the paint chart and the materials of the house. It's really, you know, it's really beautifully done. And she'd actually informed me just the other day that, I mean, I thought it was great what she sent, but she felt it was still a work in progress. And subsequently, it's become a new poem on her recent anthology. So it's quite nice that these rooms have kind of had an afterlife for a next stage as well.
It's interesting because I think out of all the lyrics, if you were to read, or certainly when I read them purely as the lyrics, because they're all on the album, you can do that. The Liz Lockhead ones, if you had to guess who had written that, I would have said Liz Lockhead. You know, it's got that essence of how he writes. Yeah, definitely.
Do you think because of the subject matter or just the...
Possibly because of the subject matter and perhaps our better known poems, certainly some of the first ones I read when I was studied Liz at university, even at school. I thought, this feels like a Liz Lockhead memory, and how she manages to put into words and create the pictures in your mind about how she was seeing that from the viewpoint of a child.
Yeah, you're right. Very visual. And she had this thing about who needs Virginia Woolf and stuff, you know, and so that kind of became a line in the chorus. And but yeah, I just love the idea that she kind of used the materials, but also, and also it chimed again, talking of kind of connection, serendipity, but, you know, with the album coming out in another coronation year last year, it sort of felt like it had a bit of a link, you know, a full circle to it.
And you mentioned Ian Rankin's one as well, "My Bedroom Was My Rocket." And that's one that really struck a chord of recognition in me, that idea of the bedroom as, you say, a safe space, and it's got your own, it's perhaps the first place where you put your own identity. You have your own posters, your own records, your own books, your own comics, whatever it might be. And that almost sparks the imagination in you that, you know, maybe takes you to where you go next, or, you know, whatever you might do next. That place, that space that you create almost in your own image. And I think all the rooms have a sense of that about them.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what was my feeling as well, from not knowing how this would go, from, you know, the original invite I received from Gordon to then my invite of the authors, and then it all kind of just, it just all had this natural flow to it. You know, it didn't really feel, it was a lot of work. I mean, I think Gordon did a brilliant job, you know, on the engineering and mixing and, you know, but it was, I think you might have needed a few weeks off after it. You know, it was quite a workload, and I just threw myself into it, you know, but at the same time, I mentioned that mainly because it also had just this kind of, more than probably any album I've made, it just had this quite effortless feeling to it. And maybe I felt it was less on me. I mean, you could say, okay, there might be a bit more pressure if you're like having all these great authors' words, but I didn't really feel that. I think I just felt, well, it's collaboration, and it's and doing it where I was doing it. You mentioned that space of a bedroom, like Ian's song, or you mentioned in your own case, and I identify with that as well. And the bank flat was like that to me, even though I didn't live there, you know, well, I stayed there sometimes, but it, you know, but my own bedroom, when I received Ian's words and I said this to him, actually, it really correlated with my own feelings of growing up Rairoch Road, North Tobermory district. My bedroom was the same. It was my rocket ship. You know, it was, I won some records at the Iris Hall in Tobermory. Just let my dog out. I mentioned earlier, my dog did bark on the album. So technically she's got every right to be in these interviews. But I won three records in the Iris Hall in Tobermory, which is where my uncles performed and where I grew up playing. And I'll be back playing there this year. We're going to do the Room album back home as well, hopefully with some of the authors. But the I won with the Beatles, Sound of Silence, Sound of the Funkle, and Queen's Greatest Hits. Every Wednesday night, it was a coffee evening and a tombola, and I won a suitcase record player with it. And I can still remember walking up from the seafront up to my house, and I learned to play as much as I could, you know, everything that was on there. And I suppose that's when the Beatles really entered my life in that way. And actually just recently been doing little posts of leading up to some of the live shows I'm doing, which maybe we'll talk about. But I discovered, talking of a bedroom, for those of you watching this, this is my old four-track recorder, which isn't Pro Tools and isn't Logic, but this is actually how I must have recorded about, as I mentioned earlier, hundreds of songs as a teenager in my bedroom, you know, so I very much identified with what Ian was talking about. And even when I got that first tour bus or first tours or things started to take off in my music, I always felt, as long as I sort of keep that kid in my close to me, then no matter how big it gets or how, you know, stressful or I don't know, you know, how, if you think, God, what's going to happen, you know, live TV or playing Glastonbury or whatever it is, I always sort of thought, okay, this is only happening because I had that passion as a kid. Yeah. And this album probably has been just an even bigger reminder of that. And people like Ian and his rooms only point towards that as well. It's just a privilege to kind of have my hand on their doors almost, you know, to kind of have that insight. Because they all, you know, it's quite revealing. And Jacqueline Wilson's room is, you know, her contribution is her first ever room of her own, a first job, a first writer's room all combined, because she was 17 and left the southeast of England to go to Dundee to work for DC Thompson. So she didn't have a title, and I called it somebody else's life, because which has become her life. But you know, she talks about it's grey dawn light. Grey dawn light. She talks about I'm 17. I'm on my own. She talks about taxi guy. You know, take me to a room. I need a room, any space to write. And because she didn't have a room sorted out, and they took her to the Church of Scotland hostel, and the matron gave her the linen cupboard, and she became the envy of all the other girls because she had the smallest room but the warmest room because it was a linen cupboard. And but she literally said she started writing there. And of course, talking of things turning, you know, full circle, DC Thompson now published the Jacqueline Wilson monthly magazine, which my daughter subscribed to. So so you know, that's amazing, isn't it, for her journey, you know? And and so it was a real privilege to kind of, you know, receive those stories, those rooms of key points in some of the author's lives, you know.
And I think as a listener, that's what you get. You're being, every time, it's a lovely way of putting it, you've been given the keys to the door, or you can open and go into this different person's memory and access to that memory. It's a really a lovely idea. And did it change your views of the rooms of the past? Or did it change you even going back and doing it? Was it, you know, how did it feel to kind of revisit your own past in such a way, in such a kind of visceral way, to go to the actual space that you know, that you know so well?
Yeah, it was quite strange going into the bank flat for the first time in all those years, because obviously I'm in Mull of Law, and I'll look up and I'll see the turret window. It's not gone anywhere in the last 20 years, you know, but I haven't been in it. I think it's been used as offices, and, you know, the bank have probably used it. So it felt very familiar, but a bit strange, you know. I mean, some of the rooms are in a bit of disrepair, and that's currently been attended to. But I think just the warmth of Gordon, for those of, Gordon's pretty well known around the Scottish music scene and creative scene, and he's such a warm individual, Gordon. And I've tagged him an angel with sideburns, and you know, it just felt extra special to spend that time with him. I mean, the amount of nonsense we talked about, and the amount of stories, and you know, but yet we got a lot of work done. I don't quite know how we did it. And so yeah, it felt quite special going back for one other reason, really. I probably haven't maybe talked about so much is, yes, it was my grandparents and my grandfather and my grandmother were a big influence on me, both sets of my grandparents. But also resident in the bank flat for the last 10 years of her life was my great-grandmother. She was called Tate, and she was from Connell, and she'd come over to Mull. And she was kind of bedridden for a lot of that time. And she died when I was maybe about 9, 10. And I just remember my brother and I would go into her room, and it was like walking into, you know, a museum or something, because she remembered Queen Victoria, and she remembered like some of the outlaws of the Wild West, you know, reading about them. She was about 20 when the Titanic went down. And so her room, Gordon really has only taken up the main living room with looking out, and the live room, my grandparents' bedroom. But the rest of it is pretty empty. So her room is completely empty. But in some ways it was kind of still full of her, you know, because she was such a sweet lady. And I can still remember singing her theme tunes, you know. So I suppose maybe there was a bit of music up there as well. But so I think the first thing I really did was walk into Tate's room, and that felt, you know, really special to kind of, because it's not often we get the chance really to, some people are lucky, maybe their parents have stayed in the same house all their life, or but you know, it was just an unexpected sort of experience, and it was slightly strange and conflicting at times, because you had all these emotions and you had this, God, I'm right here, I'm doing this here, what's going on? But I also knew I had a hell of a workload, and sure. I mean, I came off the ferry, drove to the bank flat, Had a look around, but I immediately went to the turret window and started singing the beginning of the Jacqueline Wilson song, which, because she, I'd mentioned earlier, she talks about cold nights in Dundee. I wanted to kind of start off with this repetitive phrasing of that, and I wanted to use a vocoder, and I was listening to Laurie Anderson's "Oh Superman," so I kind of had that as a reference point, and I thought I need to start there, just with my voice. So there's no instruments, no, and that's what I did the first Sunday night. I just kind of went into the turret. Gordon set me up, and so I thought, okay, before I kind of relax here too much, I just need to go on with it, you know.
That's interesting. Almost no time for a great reflection because the work had to get done and started. And you said the final track is, I wasn't sure if it was your grandfather's voice, but you said it is, and it's a spoken word piece. And there were cassettes, he had recorded cassettes that were around the place.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've got one here. So this is for those of you watching, it's kind of a red cover with my grandfather's face on it, called Angus's Cayley Collection. And yeah, I mean, you know, he had the poem I went with, I had a little bit of deliberation, because probably his most known poem is Isle of Cheese, and he'd read in the Open Times, which obviously is the Bible in the Hebrides, but Isle of Cheese was considered an aphrodisiac in Italy. So for my grandfather, this was just pure gold, you know. So the nuns are at it, and everyone, you know, it's like, it's very funny. But he also wrote very sort of nostalgic, poignant verse. I mentioned the one earlier, "Tinnult Safari," was really a kind of tribute to my grandmother, you know, and he passed the next day. And the other thing is that I mentioned earlier that Liz Lockhead's "Anaglypta" poem is a penultimate track, and I thought that will lead into my grandfather's. And she mentions being a kid, as I mentioned, in her room, and reading Lady Something's, Lady Chatterley's Lover. That slip was not intentional, but I'll explain why. So she mentions Lady Chatterley's Lover, and my grandfather's, one of his poems is called Lady Something's Lover, and it's these two old men in Oban Pier kind of saying, you know, the wife's got this book under the bed, and she's, you know, she's her head's between the pages, and I don't know, that it's Lady Something's Lover, you know, it's like you can't remember. And so I thought, well, that's quite a nice link, but that's quite a funny poem again. So I actually went with Memories of Mull, which is probably his tribute to Mull, and I think is really beautiful. It just kind of goes round the winding roads of Dervig, and it just picks out, you know, all the points of Mull, and he talks about them being tangled round his heart, and Iona is busy silently sleeping, or can't really do it justice, but it's a beautiful poem. So yeah, that was recorded in the 70s in that room, because he would record those audio versions, and the publisher would make them into cassettes, and then he would sometimes, I can remember him down the phone live on Radio Scotland, I think the Robbie Shepherd show, reciting poetry, you know. So he would, you know, there's quite a bit of his audio out there, but it just felt quite fitting that he would complete, you know, he would be the final voice on the album. And it's nice that he's in the company of all these other writers as well, you know. I mean, I suppose that seems very natural to me, but somebody pointed it out to me recently, what would your grandfather have thought of, like, the poet laureate coming up to his room to, and I thought, I suppose I hadn't really thought about it like that. You know, I don't know. I mean, he would have probably just had a big smile on his face, I think, you
And
know.
it does make, I think, the perfect end to the album, and particularly after what we've just been speaking about, perhaps even more so. And you mentioned you're going to be playing some of these songs live. I know there's a Glasgow gig at Oran Mór on the 8th of February. And it's called Bookends because it's not just going to be songs from this album, is it?
No, that's right, Alistair. So it's Bookends because I'm doing my first album, Loss, and my most recent album that we just talked about, In My Mind There's a Room. So the kind of album one and album nine on the same evening. So I'm doing, yeah, I'm doing Glasgow Oramore February 8th, and then Manchester on the 9th, and London Bush Hall on the 10th. And yeah, each night I'll be playing both those two albums. And it's also quite significant for me because Loss reached its 20th anniversary a couple of years ago, and then was reissued last year. And again, for people watching, but they were kind of nice sort of vinyl like this, and reissued on vinyl with a kind of box set called Archaeology of all my first 4 years of output, about 80 tracks. And so it's quite a, it's just, again, it's, I've been making this album while that was happening as well. So, you know, and the label have been saying, well, can you find some, you know, additional artwork or things that, you know, old photos and things. So it's been, I've been on a bit of an excavation. So it feels quite, for me, it feels quite full circle, you know, to be playing the new album and the debut album. And in Glasgow, hopefully a little extra is I'm playing this one, which is This Is Hope, which is my third album. And this has also been reissued, and it's got new artwork. That album was made, talking of Dylan and the band, that album was made in the Bearsville studios, upstate New York, in Woodstock, where they recorded. And so it was very much sort of written in Scotland, but made on the other side of the Atlantic. And it's probably a bit of a pet fave of mine of an album. I don't know. I really liked how it came together, and getting to sort of go to New Orleans and record gospel singers, and then, you know, realize it all in this kind of these studios that apparently Janis Joplin's Minnie was still in the garage because she was managed. But it was the Albert Grossman management sort of stable who had Dylan, the band, and Janis Joplin. And so that's really how Bearsville was grown on. So I mentioned that because in Glasgow and Oranmore, I'm also going to play This Is Hope. So it's going to be a lot going on. And I also have three of the authors joining me. So I've got Val McDermid, I've got Liz Lockhead, and James Robertson, who we haven't talked about yet, but his room is Seeds.
Oh,
And
it's a
James.
wonderful track, I think. Yeah, really
Oh,
good.
thank you. Yeah, I mean, that is, it's kind of, it's funny, you know, because it's the one where I just thought, okay, I'm just going to go for it here, because it's got three different sections. And but it's really, I've never met James, but it's been a real pleasure just collaborating with him. So they're all going to join for the Glasgow show, and it would be, yeah, hopefully people will come along, and it'll be a little bit different. The authors will do some readings of their rooms, and in Val's case, she's a really good singer, Val, and she plays with the fun-loving crime writers, of course. And so, Val joined me actually at the Borders Book Festival last summer, and so and to my surprise, started singing with me on stage. So I think Val will get quite involved. So yeah, that's quite nice just to kind of have the album going to all these other rooms and reaching, you know, hopefully some of the audience as well.
And would you ever consider doing something like this again, a part two?
Yes.
Yes. That's the quickest answer I've ever
That'll be my shortest answer. Yeah, no, I am. I'm thinking about it. I want to do, well, again, I'm just sharing thoughts, but I'm
Yeah.
imagining maybe three of them, like a series.
Yeah.
And I think I've got a good sense of what it's going to be next. So I think it should always be in my mind, there's a, and
Good.
so I need to think about, yeah, that, I mean, I've got quite a few balls in the air at the moment with the novel and other musical I'm working on, but it's nice to know that hopefully it had a nice outcome, and that when all the authors then heard their songs, thankfully they all seemed to be quite pleased with it. And so I feel like I've really enjoyed it, and it's just been nice to collaborate and work with other creatives, you know, other storytellers. So yeah, definitely going to do it again, and going to move on to that probably at some point this year, you know.
Well, that's great. That's really exciting news. And can you tell us a little bit about the novel since you've mentioned it? Is that possible?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's called When the Needle Drops, and so far I had a novel. My debut novel was called The Letters of Ivor Punch,
Yeah.
and then I had a memoir, sort of some of the stuff we've talked about growing up in Mull and whatnot, and then a kid's book. So I was thinking what to do next, and a little bit like this album, when you have these, well, hopefully they are light bulbs, but you know, you have these kind of thoughts where you think, okay, yeah, that makes sense, and I'll do it. And I thought, okay, Ivor Punch in the debut novel, for anyone who hasn't read it, is a retired police sergeant on an island. So it you know, it looks and smells and sounds a lot like Mull, but it also goes back to Victorian times. It travels to America and the White House, and but Ivor is a sort of thread that runs through it. And the thought I had was that I would reprise Ivor in a crime series.
Right.
So he's no longer retired, you know, he's in the job. And this came around, actually, talking of Orrin Moore, because I adapted The Letters of Ivor Punch for the play Pie Pint series. And I'd never written a play before. You know, I had a lot of help from people like Stuart Hepburn and the producers there at Play Pie Pint. But I really enjoyed that. And really, I just returned to his voice for the play. You know, this was a couple few years ago, and that would, you know, that was a year or two after the novel. So I felt like I could just shake this guy's hand, you know. And I had a lot of different writing on the go, and I suddenly thought, I kind of feel this is Ivor's book again. And so it's When the Needle Drops. It's no longer the island, you know. It's very much set on Mull, and it's my sort of reimagining a bit of the Great Mull Air Mystery. So I don't know if you know about this, but this is one of the biggest pieces of folklore that I haven't yet tapped into in Mull. But in the mid-70s, a plane went missing, a light plane went missing from the airstrip, the airfield in Mull, the airfield we used to use as a football pitch, actually. But it, and it never the plane never returned, and the whole island was out looking, apparently. And if you Google the Great Mull Air Mystery, it's you know, it was quite a big story in the end. And they found the body 4 months later on a hillside.
Right.
And they didn't find the plane for many years. And there was lots of really, you know, the body seemed to have kind of, was there a, what's the word I'm looking for? A suspicion maybe that the plane had gone into the Sound of Mull. But then he didn't seem to have seawater on him, but then he'd been exposed for many months. It was just lots of mystery, and I mean, that's one story itself. But I, a little bit like the author's rooms, you know, I didn't want to know too much more. I
Sure.
mean, you could Google this and research it till kingdom come, but I just thought, I've always known about it, and I thought, oh, maybe that could be a thread running through the book. And so yeah, it comes out in May, and it's with the publisher Black and White, who are based in Edinburgh. It's probably the first time I've actually had a link with a publisher or a label or anything in my career that's actually Scottish based,
Right.
despite all the mullness. So it's quite nice. It feels like, you know, it feels like hopefully that's a new relationship, and we're calling it the Mull Mysteries series.
Oh,
So
fantastic. So a series, that's good to hear as well.
yeah, so that's underway with the first book, and no pressure with Ian Rankin and Val McDermid floating around my album, you know. So it's but it's kind of, it's very much character led, and I've tried to just evoke, you know, the characteristics of the people of the islands, you know. But I think, like everything I do, I don't want it to be just about insular, you know. Hopefully it's about kind of reaching out and how the mainland interacts with the islands, and so it's all that kind of stuff. But yeah, that's quite nice to have off the desk and done and dusted.
Well, Colin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I love the album and all the very best with the live shows.
Well, really pleased. Thanks, Alistair. Thanks for all the insightful questions, and I'm pleased that the album's been down well. Thank you.
And all the links to where you can get the album and tickets to the shows are over at scotswayhay.com. And we'll be back soon with someone completely different.